Pleasure today to be sitting in the square in Solia talking to Siân Mackay. Siân is a prolific writer, and today she's going to tell us her story of a book launch we are anticipating this week, and also with huge Majorcan influences and Solioric influences, because Siân lived here for a good length of time and these days comes backwards and forwards. Welcome, Siân. Thank you very much for agreeing to talk to us on Boat Radio.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a great pleasure. It's so exciting to be on the island with my book, having been finished after about 8 years of research. And I hope it will be of interest to people in Mallorca, because a lot of the book is set in Mallorca. It's a biography about a man called Baron Rudolf von Ripper, who bought a villa near Pollença, where he stayed for the last 10 years of his life.
But I believe that this whole journey, for want of a better word, started with an envelope. A blue envelope, is that true?
Actually, a blue file, such as you can buy in any island stationery shops with elastic closures. What happened was, I was working as a journalist in Palma when I got a telephone call from an acquaintance who knew that I was researching the lives of historical expatriates who had lived on the island, such as the Archduke Louis Salvador and Frédéric Chopin, Georges Sand, and Robert Graves. And so she said she'd found a blue file of letters and photographs abandoned at a villa in Pollença, and would I like to take a look? So I went out for lunch, and the file was lying on the table, and I was so impatient for her to open it, but we had to have lunch, and then and then she opened it, and I said, but what were you doing in an abandoned villa in Pollença? So she said, well, I was looking for a villa that would be suitable for an art school, a summer art school on behalf of a Scottish artist. And I came to this villa, which was very different from any other villa I had seen on the island. And I thought it would be perfect, lovely big white open spaces inside. And I wandered out to the garden, and there was a swimming pool covered with slime because the villa had been abandoned for several years. And there was a changing pavilion beside the swimming pool. And when I opened the door, it was as if I entered a time warp, because there were hanging all these evening clothes, moldy with damp and age. They'd been there for over 40 years. And underneath, I found this blue file. And when I opened it, it was full of photographs and letters that some of them written in old German script and others in English. And I thought, well, if we take on this villa, they'll clear this. They'll take all the stuff out of here and they'll throw it in the bin. So I decided to rescue the file because something told me it was important. So she rescued the file, and thank goodness she rescued it and that it came into my hands, because it's resulted in the story of one of the most remarkable men of the first half of the 20th century.
I think that is, well, just the story of getting hold of it. But I mean, did you have to get permission in the end to use it, having come into the possession of these documents? Did you have to find out where they originated and get permission to continue with your work with it?
Well, once I delved into it, it was quite difficult to find out any information about Baron Rudolf von Ripper, because Wikipedia hadn't been invented then, for example. It was very slow putting together any information about him, because the blue file covered the last decade of his life, and this is what's important about it, because nobody knew very much at all about the last 10 years of his life until the discovery of this file. So piece by piece, I went forward as a researcher, and I contacted, in the end, two nephews. But the file had been abandoned, and the question was, did it really belong to anybody? And so nobody could say it belongs to me or it belongs to so-and-so or so-and-so. So I went ahead with it. And of late, I've made very good contact with Rudolf von Ripper's great nephew, who's the director of two major galleries in Dresden, Dr. Stefan Koja. And he's been wonderful. He gave me permission to use illustrations from Ripper's work and is very excited about the event. And I'm delighted to say that he's arriving for the launch on Friday in Central Palma. And at the launch, I'm going to present the file to him for safekeeping in his archive.
Oh, I think that's lovely. So it's found its way home then. It's given you the information you needed. It's given the world the book. And now it's going back home to the people it belongs to. I think that's actually lovely. So tell us the story of Mr. von Ripper. Who is he? Who was he?
Well, I have to be brief here because this man's life was filled with so many exciting episodes, and each episode in his life was filled with so many stories that a novelist would be hard put to imagine. So it's hard to be brief, but I will try. He was born in 1905 to Countess Salis Samaden, who was a very high-ranking Austrian aristocrat, and his father was a general in the Austria-Hungary army. So his father brought him up to be a soldier, but his mother saw artistic possibilities and had her son trained from a very early age in art. Now, his father was killed at the end of the First World War in 1918, and his mother refused to let young Ripper, who was 13 at that stage, become the next Baron. He wasn't old enough, she said. And so for a couple of years, he ran away from school, he created problems for the countess, and eventually he decided to run away, and he crossed the Austria-German border with a traveling theater troupe. And once he was in Germany, he joined a circus, and that took him north to a place called Duisburg, where he had heard that people were hiring men for work in the coal mine, and he was anxious to get whatever work he could, you know, because he had no money.
How old was he at this stage?
He'd be 13, 14. So he worked in the coal mine, and then someone saw his ability and gave him a commission to design wallpaper. So he had money in his pocket, enough to join the Dusseldorf School of Art. God. Now that just these little episodes at the beginning are extraordinary, but this goes on throughout his life. He never settled. He was a lonely traveler, an international wanderer. He finds his way to Berlin. He gets to meet all the people, the artists and writers that are living in Berlin at the time, Nabokov. Ernest Hemingway became a friend throughout his life. He could open the doors of any atelier or house that he wanted to because of his pedigree and his personality. He was an extraordinarily charismatic man, there's no doubt about that. So eventually from Berlin, he goes on a trip with his great friend Klaus Mann, who is the son of Thomas Mann, and they go to China to make documentary films. He works for an American arms dealer from Minnesota, who's trading arms for both sides of the Chinese Civil War, and one day he arrives for work and finds his boss shot through with bullets, and he's warned that his name is on the hit list, and so he gets out.
You've only covered in what you've just said a few years, really. By this stage, this guy's not very old, is he?
No, he's about 22, 23.
So he's already running away from China because in case he, to escape the next bullet. But looking at your book, Von Ripper's Odyssey, you describe it as war, resistance, art, and love. So we've got him till he's 22. He dies at what age?
55.
He packs a lot into that life then, doesn't he?
He's extraordinary. Quite extraordinary.
So
a writer's dream.
An absolute writer's dream. So what comes next then? So where does he go after China? I'm sorry, I don't think we can allow you to actually short-circuit this. It's fascinating.
He marries Dorothea Sternheim, who's the daughter of Karl Sternheim, the great German playwright. and they're into drugs and having drug and alcohol fueled parties in Berlin. But they also spend time in Paris, where they meet all the great surrealist artists, the Catalan artists, Miro, Picasso, Salvador Dalí, and they enter a menage a trois with René Crevel, the surrealist writer. So the Paris days are how they were. Cole Porter was around. Everyone was singing his songs, the hit songs of the day. They were right there doing the whatever dance they did. What was it?
Charleston.
The Charleston. Yes, yes, the Charleston. But he's running out of money. So what does he do? He joins the French Foreign Legion.
Of course you do. Now, by this stage, is he a baron? Has his mum allowed him to become the baron then?
Well, yes, he had the titular. He was a titular baron, but he wasn't allowed to practice being a baron by his mother because he was too young. And then she couldn't lure him back. She tried to lure him back to Austria to take the reins of the family, but by that time he was out in the world and there was no going back for him.
So hedonism, drink, drugs, sex, rock and roll, as it was yes. then, had got him.
Yes, yes. But he was a serious artist. He was a graphic artist, and he was producing graphic art for German magazines. Now, okay, he had a spell in the French Foreign Legion. I'll just say yeah. that in the battle with the Druze in Lebanon, he had a punctured lung, which resulted in him walking slightly bent to one side for the rest of his life. But back in Germany, he had a commission from the... We're jumping forward a few years. He got a commission from the German underground to create art, anti-fascist art, from a place of safety. Now, that was 1933. It was early, but still the Nazi Party really was on the march, and Hitler was already chancellor and so on. And he was appalled by what he saw happening. In the beginning, the arrests were of intellectuals and homosexuals, not so much Jewish people. So he chose Mallorca as his place of safety. And he came to Mallorca and he created that art. It's not exactly known where he stayed, but he stayed in Palma and Poyenza. And I like to think that he met the artists of the Poyenza school, which was well established. And it was supported by a South American guy called Adán Diels, who built the Hotel Formentor. And the artists would take their work to the Hotel Formentor, and he would encourage rich clients to buy the art, thus supporting the Escuela Poyenza. So he goes back to Germany, and he's arrested in Berlin by the Gestapo, who've raided his apartment in Berlin and found evidence to suggest that he's been helping people to escape to Switzerland. We're talking about Jewish people now. And also because of his, as they classed it, degenerate art. You know, all through the Second World War, the Nazis were confiscating degenerate art.
What's the definition of degenerate art then?
Anything that was abstract or surreal or out of the ordinary. And his certainly was. So he's arrested by the Gestapo. He's taken to a hellhole of a prison in Berlin called Tempelhof, where he endures the most terrible torture and has his skull cracked open by Nazi jackboots. And he has to endure a mock execution, which probably resulted in the angina that he would go on to suffer for the rest of his life. They tried to make him confess that he tried to help people to escape from Germany and that he created degenerate art, but he refused to sign the confession. And he kept insisting that he was being held illegally because he was an Austrian citizen. They didn't know what to do with him, so they sent him to the first concentration camp, which was called Oranienburg, north of Berlin. This was full of intellectuals and former people he'd known in his civilian life. He has a James Bond-style escape from the concentration camp. And before he goes, the camp commandant, which this is important, he's called SS Diels, says to him, "Keep your mouth shut. Be careful. The Gestapo arm is very long and can reach across borders." wherever you go. So where does he go? He goes to report to the resistance in Amsterdam and London, and then he goes back to Mallorca.
But before he does that, how does he get out? What's his James Bond escape?
Well, you'll have to read the book
Oh, no, I have to get the book. But carry on.
So, and I want to really convey how important Mallorca was to him. So all through that hell he's been living, he's had thoughts of his first visit to Mallorca. The sun, the warmth, the colours, the textures. Surely that kept him sane during this terrible period. So he's determined now to concentrate on his art, and he arrives back in Mallorca. And in Mallorca that year, for a whole year he was here, the year of 1934 into 1935, and he starts to create his masterwork. His masterwork began with drawings conceived in Mallorca and were later made into prints to secure their permanency. He was very influenced by the surrealists, and he also had a tremendous knowledge of art history going back to the medieval period. Dürer, for instance, and some of his drawings were influenced by Hieronymus Bosch. So it was a very eclectic mixture of things. So there were 16 of these prints. And now for the next few years, the Gestapo were on his heels wherever he went. They tried to close an exhibition in London of some of the drawings he'd made in Mallorca, but a very important personage who wanted to remain confidential refused on the basis that Britain was a free country and they couldn't just come and demand that an art gallery be closed. And I'm pretty sure that important personage was Winston Churchill.
Really? Can I just recap a bit on his love life at that point? Is he still married? Have we still got the lady in tow?
Yes, he's still married, but they're finding it very difficult to stay together. However, Ripper sees the writing on the wall that he's not going to ever escape the Gestapo in Europe, and he's very worried about the fate of his drawings. And so his wife, whose nickname was Mopsa, and he go to stay in Belgium, and she helps him with the aid of a printing press to turn the drawings into etchings on copper plates, which can then be printed up. So Mopsa was very supportive at that period, but really they found it very difficult to live together permanently.
Yeah. So where is the archive of these paintings now?
With Dr. Stefan Kodja, who I mentioned before, Ripper's great nephew. But I saw the work in New York public libraries, where I was able to photograph them. And that was the first time I'd actually seen his work. And it was a very exciting moment to see what amazing work it was.
So it's not hung anywhere. I mean, it's not in any gallery anywhere.
Not yet. Yeah. But it would be wonderful to see an exhibition in Mallorca, say in some baluard or at the Miró Foundation.
Yeah, now that'd be. Is that your next project when all this is done?
No, I'm not an art curator. So I leave that to other people to pick up as a result of the book.
But carry on, because this is some fantastic story. So he's off to America now, is he?
Yes, he set sail on the SS Rotterdam at the end of 1938. In January 1939. Time magazine puts one of his prints on its front cover. It's the first time they've used art instead of a photograph on the front cover. So he's the toast of the town overnight. And a lot of his friends are there. Klaus Mann and his sister Erika, for example, are living in a shared house with Winston Auden, you know, the British poet, and Peter Pears, the singer. He knew a lot of people in New York. In the course of his time in America, he won 2 Guggenheim Fellowships. His work was exhibited by Picasso's dealer in America. He was given a summer residency at an artist's retreat called Yaddo in upstate New York. And here there's a very nice personal story, because when I was doing the research, I looked at the website to find Yaddo was still in existence. And I thought, holy smoly, I thought it had been gone long ago. And it said how to apply, and I pressed the button, and I saw that because I was a published author that I could apply. So I applied to go to the same place as Ripper had been, and I was given a 6-week summer residency there in 2010. And it was fantastic to be in that place, which hadn't changed since his day. And there's a photograph of him standing in the Great Hall. It's a very Jacobean mansion, beside the statue of the goddess Athena, who was the goddess of war, very appropriately for Ripper. And I was able to stand exactly where he stood in the photograph. Anyway, the Yaddo residents gathered round the radio and heard World War II being declared. And he was there with three other Nazi refugees, one of them who had a heart attack after the news about the Second World War and died in his bathtub. And Ripper, being the youngest of the refugees, was detailed to take the body, the coffin, to New York to a refugee organization. So he's talking all the time about what's going on in Germany and trying to get Americans to listen, but they can't really imagine the horror of it. So as soon as Pearl Harbor happened and the Americans joined the Allies, he becomes an American citizen and applies to join the army, but he's got a heart murmur, he's got a punctured lung, he's not very good material for on the face of it, but they give him a posting as a war artist, and he's sent to North Africa, and then on to the Italian campaign in 1942. And although the war art department was disbanded in 1943, Ripper kept drawing. He kept drawing. He was fighting and drawing and fighting and drawing because he hoped that one day his artwork from the war would be published. And that I saw in the archive of the American Military History Museum in Washington, D.C. So he goes in as a corporal, and his feats of derring do during the war are beyond belief. He killed 63 Nazis, and he was adept at going behind the lines on his own and picking them off. Well, you see, he'd been trained as an aristocratic sportsman to hunt game in his estates when he was a boy. And he'd been trained as a marksman by his general father, so it was in his blood. So after the war, he comes out with the highest military decorations of the American Army it's possible to get. He's been an intelligence officer for the Office of Strategic Services. And his last heroic act of the war is really important as far as Majorca and Ripper are concerned, was to arrest Otto Skorzeny, who was called Hitler's favorite general. And Skorzeny was a friend of SS Diels, who was the commandant of the concentration camp, who had condoned Ripper's torture and told him to watch out for the long arm of the Gestapo. So, they're arch enemies, but with Skorzeny safely behind bars, Ripper packs up his kit bag and heads to Paris, and goes to a grand party at the home of a Vicomtesse who collects his work. And at the party, Mopsa, his first wife, appears, and Ripper asks her for a divorce, which she doesn't want, but has to agree to because their lives are so different now, and they've both experienced horrors that are very difficult to come to terms with. So they separated, and he went back to New York. And he had a studio in Connecticut where he told a journalist he liked to dance to Fats Waller and Bach. So he would dance around the studio in his shorts and in the summer heat, and trying to get back his reputation as an artist, trying to paint but with some block. So one of his escapades at that time was he took some contemporary American art and also a work of Kandinsky, but Jackson Pollock. He smuggled them over the border into Austria because he wanted his fellow countrymen to see the sort of art that was being produced in America. Ripper was brought to America fleeing the Gestapo by an American billionaire benefactor called Cummins Catherwood, who had a foundation who was bringing artists from Europe over to America. So when he gets back from Austria, Cummins Catherwood is there saying, "Hey, Ripper, do you fancy coming on an expedition to the Bahamas to draw the marine life?" So off he goes, and on board comes this stunning goddess called Avi Ligi, who's an American socialite and extremely beautiful. And they fall in love and they get married on board the SS Vigilante. So now he's a CIA agent, because Cummins Catherwood, who I've just mentioned, was one of the biggest CIA benefactors. And he had operations extending over the Iron Curtain into Russia. And it was all about winning the hearts and minds of Europeans over communism. So Ripper was sent as a cultural attaché to the Vienna Academy of Arts.
Was this undercover?
Everybody was undercover, but nearly everyone in the arts who was American in Europe was a CIA agent of some sort or another.
Really? I've learned something today. Really? So there's no genuine art. You're actually an agent. Oh, I'm an artist. No, I'm not. I'm a CIA agent. Fantastic.
Yeah, they're looking for communists that could be turned to prefer American culture. It's not a sinister appointment by any means, and he built up the academy tremendously, but their dream was to live in Mallorca, and so in 1951 they came down to Mallorca with Ripper's sister, and they stayed in the hotel in Palma, and then they went right out to Pollença. And I think he saw the Villa Cancaig earlier, because they go there and they decide that that's the villa for them. And the following year, Ripper comes back, and on her behalf, because the money that paid for the villa was Avi's, buys the villa. Thus begins their life, the last 10 years in Mallorca.
So they arrived to live here full-time. What year then? What are we talking about?
1952.
And then what did he do? Did they just relax and have a good time?
There was a lot of La Dolce Vita, and there are photographs of them having swanky parties by the swimming pool. And a Mallorcan neighbor, who's still alive and was a child then, remembers the incredible parties that they had there, where limousines were lining the street right up to the Palma Pollença Road, and people arriving in fabulous gowns with big billowing skirts and fur stoles. And she said, fue otro mundo. It was another world. Because Mallorcans hadn't really even seen many Hollywood films then. So there was a lot of that. And in order to keep Avi in the style she wanted, the Baron turned to jewelry design, which wasn't unusual because a lot of artists at the time, notably Salvador Dali, were designing jewelry. Ripper had known Salvador Dali in New York, and they had the same benefactor, Cummins Catherwood. So in 1954, Salvador Dali invited Ripper to go to Rome with him, where he was exhibiting his surrealist jewelry. And Rip's designation was Keeper of the Dali Jewels, because amongst the jewels was the Royal Heart. It was made of diamonds and rubies, and it actually had a beat to it, and it was priceless. So Ripper had to guard that, but he was quite happy because he would make lots of wonderful contacts for his own jewelry business. And in the end, they were selling to the House of Chanel and Bonwit Teller in New York.
And the house, the Ripper house, then, was it absolutely huge? Was it kind of a night manager type style place?
Not at all, no. It was very modernist in style. It could have been designed by an architect such as Mies van der Rohe of the Bauhaus, because it's a cuboid. It's white and it's cuboid. And it's not very large inside, but it has a very elegant atmosphere. It had five bedrooms, with en-suites and several living rooms, a kitchen which hasn't changed much today, where there's an enormous Westinghouse fridge to cater for their parties. It's got about 6 doors to it. And that was the Ripper's refrigerator. And a wine cellar, of course. Ripper conceded to Ivy's wish to have a swimming pool. He was against it because of the water shortage at the time, but in the end, she needed her swimming pool. And he got his studio on the other side of the road. He built a purpose-built studio. But by 1954, things were not so happy for the Rippers. Avi had a miscarriage, and Ripper would have loved to have been a father. And she fell in love with their estate manager, which was not necessarily a problem, because Ripper would have taken the view that you can't legislate for people falling in love. And he himself had many love affairs in his life. So my take on it is that he thought that as long as Avi wouldn't leave him, he would turn a blind eye to anything that was going on, and we don't know exactly what was going on, except that it was a passionate love. This is documented in some letters. But one of the severest challenges I believe he faced was Otto Skorzeny, the ex-Nazi general whom he had arrested in the Alps, moved into a villa a mile away in Alcudia.
No, really? What, was he after him, or was it just coincidence?
Who knows? Mallorca was a safe haven for many agents, former Nazis and spies, who gathered with the rich and famous, for example, at the Hotel Formentor near Pollença. Skorzeny, he had his own reasons. I don't think it was just Ripper, because it's said that he created a rat line in the front of his property, which was on the coast, where ex-Nazis could escape to South America. I'm not a boatie, so I don't know what their route would be, but they would get onto some kind of a boat at Alcudia and be transferred, presumably, to an ocean-going liner to South America. Otto Skorzeny was one of the people who hoped to establish a Fourth Reich in South America.
So the Fourth Reich is being sent people from Mallorca as a holding place then. Is that what we're saying?
Yes. Well, they would come from Spain. They would come from wherever they had been in Europe. But it wasn't the only rat line. There were many rat lines by many ex-Nazis on the coast of Europe.
So I'm just trying to define this. This is a rat line. So this is getting all the rats off the sinking ship out so that they can create a war utopia somewhere else. Is that the definition?
Yes, yeah. A fascist-dominated society, yes.
So what happened to Ripper then at that point? He sees his arch-enemy down the road. It's as if someone's writing a script here.
Yes, but I think, you know, Ripper was a very sophisticated man, and he would know that bonhomie was the way to go with your former wartime enemies. And so if they met in Café Soroik or Pollença or whatever, they would have even maybe sat down and had a beer together. But Skorzeny wasn't the only one around. In the letters, there's mention of a man called Schmidt. And I don't know what his true identity was. However, in 1959, the Baron and Baroness prepared to go on a trip to the Orient to collect semi-precious stones for their jewelry business, and in all probability for Salvador Dali as well, because they were big buddies and they shared the same benefactor. And I spoke to Cummins Catherwood's son, and he thinks it's highly likely that this trip to the Orient was something to do with Dali as well. So they're 3 months away, and when they come back, they go back to Paris, and here there's different versions of the story, but the one I have chosen is the one that Rip sets off with the semi-precious stones in the boot of his car to the French-Spanish border, and he's going to deliver Dali's share of the loot, and Avi's going to follow a few days later. He gets to the border, and they're waiting for him, and they ask him to pull the car aside. So he immediately goes for his back pocket to bring out a wad of notes, because that's what he's done all his life crossing borders. If there'd been any trouble, bring out a wad of notes and they'll let you through. Ninguna problema. It doesn't work this time. And he's arrested. The jewels are confiscated. He's taken to Barcelona jail. I don't know how long he was there. I don't suppose it was for more than a couple of days. He's sent back to Mallorca without his passport, without his Chevrolet, and without the jewels. He's alone at the house. He sent the servants away. He probably just was in such shock that he had to process everything that had happened at the border, because he'd been told by a detective that someone had set him up. So who was it? Was it Scozzani and Schmidt? Was it the CIA? Was it fascists? I don't know, but all I can say is that very shortly afterwards, he was found drowned in the swimming pool. And a friend of his who was at the time, actually, the European correspondent of the New York Times, Cyrus Sulzberger, wrote to Avi that the Nazis had persecuted him ever since his incarceration in 1933 until his death in 1960.
So we don't know how he died, really, then. Did he just die? Was he pushed?
Exactly. The present owner said the story she got was that he died of a heart attack in the garage. And that's the one that the servants told. However, Avi wouldn't have wanted to say that someone had drowned in the swimming pool if she wanted to rent the villa out to rich American clients or to sell the villa in the future. And there's evidence in the file that leads me to believe that he drowned in the swimming pool. But I can't say, of course, for certain how he died. And I give all the options to the reader, who must make up their own minds.
Well, this is just one fantastic story. And it's not even a story, it's true. Somebody could have written this story and it would have been a wonderful flight of imagination. But the fact that it's not, the fact that it's all based on a true story is just fantastic. So how long did you live with this information and this story searing through your creativity?
I was actively researching and writing it for about 8 years. Yes, and I traveled to America to see his work. And I went to Oranienburg. What's left of it is just a red brick wall at Oranienburg, because they only operated that for a couple of years before it was just a test to see if concentration camps would work. And then they built the next one at Sachsenhausen, which is just a mile away. And I went to Sachsenhausen, and everybody should go to a concentration camp just to... You cannot get the measure of it. And you just go around that bleak place thinking, these were people just like me. Yeah. My greatest hope is that his art will be recognized as worthy of standing beside his contemporaries such as Otto Dix and George Grosz and Kathy Kollwitz. His work is what's truly important. He had this amazing life. It's a great story. But if out of it comes exhibitions of his work, then I will feel I've done the job that I really wanted to do.
So your ambition was much bigger than the book then, always?
Yes, after I saw his art in New York Public Libraries, yes. I'm not an art historian, but I knew this was good when I saw it.
And that's a nice place to end, because this has been a real pleasure. I've loved listening to your story, and congratulations on such a huge amount of work. And we wish you all the success in the world with this publication and everything else you do in the future here in Mallorca. Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening, Shirley, and asking such great questions.